Welcome to System Change Alliance podcast on carbon capture and beyond. And I'm here today with Kim By Bruun from Northern Lights, a Norwegian company. He's the Communications and Government Relations Director for Northern Lights. And this is a company that has developed the first open source CO2 transport and storage infrastructure. And it is part of a collaboration with the Norwegian government, which has a project called Longship, and which is a full-scale carbon capture storage project. So welcome, Kim. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
So maybe you can first talk a little bit about your own background and how you got involved with this project.
Yeah, so first of all, I'm actually educated as a sociologist, and then I've studied business on top of that. But I worked for an NGO for many years, Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, where I was a field coordinator and logistician in various projects around the world. And during that time, I kind of got a perspective with regard to the global needs and how I personally could assist and help. That inspired me as well to move into focusing on environmental challenges, which has been the focus of much of my career. I've been mainly working within communications and government relations, but I joined in the oil and gas company Shell back in 2006, and worked then on sustainability for many years, and got the opportunity to get involved in carbon capture and storage while I was working for them. A couple of years ago, I was transferred to the Northern Lights joint venture, which is a collaboration between three oil and gas companies, Shell, Equinor, and TotalEnergies, who are more and more venturing into these type of projects, away from fossil fuels. And carbon capture storage is one of the areas that they're focusing on right now. And we see a lot of compatibility with skills and experience used in the oil and gas industry with carbon capture and storage. So for me, that has been very inspiring, having focused on sustainability also during my time with Shell. Now being able to take that experience and competence that I've developed myself into a completely new field, but related. But then fully kind of sustainable in a way, in the sense that no longer involved in production of hydrocarbons.
Mm-hmm. So as you know, and as everybody know, we're in the middle of an environmental crisis. We need to reduce carbon. We need to keep the temperatures down. And the Paris Agreement, says that we need to reduce it to no more than 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. So is this situation regarding the climate crisis the main impetus for this project?
So I would say that for the Northern Lights joint venture, that the key focus here is to deliver on the ambitions of the Norwegian government. So we are the transport and storage component of the Longship project, as you mentioned, which is an ambitious project by the Norwegian government, capturing CO2 from industrial emissions and storing them safely in the subsurface of the North Sea. Now, this is done because we need to meet the climate ambitions. Otherwise, there would be no reason for doing this, because it's expensive, because it's complex, but we have to do it. And what we are doing is developing a carbon transport and storage system as a service. And being the transport and storage component of the Norwegian government's Longship project, we are kind of part of a full value chain. But more than that, we're developing an open and flexible infrastructure for emitters across Europe. So we're not only tied to the emitters which are part of the Norwegian full-scale value chain. We are in a conversation with a number of emitters across Europe for transport of their CO2 to Norway by ship, and then injection into a pipeline for permanent storage in a reservoir 100 kilometers offshore and 2,600 meters under the seabed in the North Sea.
Mm-hmm. So I understand that you're working with a cement factory in the southern part of Norway. Is that one of your main projects? So can you explain a little bit, maybe technically, for someone who doesn't know what this would mean, you know, to capture the carbon produced by a cement factory? And then I understand you're shipping that out and then burying it down under the sea. And so maybe you could explain a little bit about how that would take place.
Yeah. So first, maybe I should say that capture of CO2 is not a new technology. Solvents have been used for capture of CO2 since the 1930s. And there are multiple units in operation around the world today. Transport of CO2 is not new either. In some parts of the world, CO2 pipelines have been in operation since the 1970s, and particularly in the US. There are 2,600 kilometers of existing CO2 pipelines in operation today. And ship transport of CO2 is based on modified LPG shipping technology. So, you know, both the capture and the transport component, well-known technology, nothing revolutionary, I would say. Storage of CO2 is not new either. Injection of CO2 for oil recovery has been done in the US since the 1970s. CO2 has been stored on the Norwegian continental shelf since 1996 in the Sleipner field in the North Sea. Storage capacity is not a limiting factor. The Norwegian authorities are estimating that the storage capacity on the Norwegian continental shelf alone is 80 billion tons. Of course, that is a theoretical capacity. Now, further work needs to be done in order to prove that that capacity is actually there. And we have started doing so in our concept, and we need to also develop capacity over and above what we are going to use. Capture from the cement facility in Norway, which is Norcem Cement, which is part of the Heidelberg Group, is going to be ready in 2024. We will pick that CO2 up from their site and take it by ship to a temporary storage facility in Øygarden in Western Norway, which is currently being developed. This is going to be a receiving terminal where we will have storage tanks, a jetty, and the pipeline 100 kilometers offshore down to the storage reservoir. There will be injection pumps, a substation, of course, an administration building and a workshop, etc. And this is currently being developed, also going to be ready in 2024. The ships are being constructed. We have placed the shipbuilding contract. They will be ready early 2024. And the storage reservoir, well, the first storage well has been drilled, and we're drilling a second well next year. And altogether, we will have capacity to receive and store around 1.5 million tons of CO2 per year in the first development phase. But we have already started looking at a second development phase, increasing storage capacity up to 5 million tons per year, which will allow us to take CO2 from a number of European emitters as well.
Mm-hmm. So would that be enough for that one factory, or would it be able to store the CO2 from many different factories? Just to for a layperson understanding of the amount, you know, because 1.5 million ton is abstract.
I appreciate that. And in this case, for the cement factory we're talking about here in Norcem, they have they will capture 400,000 tons of CO2, which we will receive and store. There is also another facility, a waste-to-energy facility in Oslo, which is also going to capture 400,000 tons, which we will receive and store. And that means that since we have capacity to take around 1.5 million tons per year, we will have a spare capacity of around 700,000 tons that we will be able to offer to other emitters and in the first phase. And in the second phase, that will be up to 5 million tons. So we will have even higher capacity and can take more CO2 from other emitters. The investments that need to be done on the emitter side is quite significant. So obviously, this is not something that is going to be capturing capacity is not going to be developed quickly. Investment decisions need to be made, support mechanisms need to be in place, and contracts need to be signed. And there are also some regulatory issues that need to be overcome. So the cement factory we're talking about at Norcem, I would say, is medium size. It's so 400,000 tons from them, medium sized cement factory. By the way, the cement industry is responsible for around 7% of the global CO2 emissions. And the cement industry is also an industry which cannot easily decarbonize in any other way, because the CO2 is basically a byproduct from the production. It's not due to use of energy, for example. So use of renewable energy to decarbonize the production of cement is basically not going to be an option. And for waste to energy, the same thing. So waste to energy, it's basically the incineration of waste, household waste, from we generate way too much waste, and that's a completely different discussion altogether. We need to reduce the amount of waste, but either way, when waste is being incinerated and burned, there are emissions associated with that. Now, there is also a bio component in that process, because the residual heat can be used to create energy, and that is happening at the Oslo Fortum Varma waste to energy facility, which we're talking about here. And therefore, there will also be a component of negative emissions in what they're doing. So that's important to keep in mind. But the type of industry that we're targeting is the hard to abate industry, and it's not kind of in conflict with everything that is being done to create additional renewable capacity across Europe. These things need to happen in parallel.
Mm-hmm. Right. I was reading an article in Forbes magazine by James Morris, and he was mentioning a project by Chevron in Australia. And so it was kind of a critical article. He was basically saying that there's a lot of hoopla around carbon capture, and he was using that project as an example, saying that it was supposed to bury 80% of the CO2 from gas wells in Western Australia, but that they haven't achieved, you know, more than half of that, not even half of that. So there is obviously some skepticism around these projects. So what would you say to such skepticism? What would be your reply to that? You know, and also maybe talk a little bit about the challenges that these projects are facing.
Yeah, so I'm not familiar with the details of the project in Australia, but I can say generally that, you know, what is important when storing CO2 is continuous monitoring. All areas of CO2 reservoirs are kept under close kind of monitoring at all times, the well, the cap rock, and the geology, the rock formations are monitored for changes in pressure and CO2 concentration levels. And this monitoring takes place during all phases of a CO2 reservoir's life, at the identification stage and the injection stage, up to and after closure. And predicting the CO2 movement or migration within the reservoir is also very important. Now, this is very strictly regulated, there is in Europe a CO2 storage directive in place, which regulates how this is going to be done and what kind of monitoring will be required. Liability is an aspect covered there as well. So the storage operator have incentives to get it right, of course. There is sufficient experience with this use of this technology. As I mentioned, in Norway, since 1996, the Sleipner field in the North Sea has been storing CO2 safely and without any type of issues. Now, in terms of the challenges related to what's going on in Australia, as I said, I'm not familiar with the details there. But the overall, you know, the CO2 that, based on what you were saying now, the CO2 that is being captured and stored there, is taken from gas production. That's a very different thing from what we're doing. We're taking industrial emissions. And therefore, it's not related to production and use of fossil fuels. So the question really becomes, you know, what are the alternatives? We need to get this right. We really depend on it. Also, because, you know, we are looking at storage of CO2 capture directly from the air as well, direct air capture. If it's one thing that we know, that in order to reach the climate goals, it's not enough to stop existing emissions. We also need to remove emissions from the atmosphere, that CO2 need to be either utilized or stored safely, and we can offer that safe storage.
Mm-hmm. And the storage, is that stored in old oil wells, or are you drilling new areas for the storage?
Yeah, in some parts of the world, they are using depleted oil and gas fields. That's not what mm-hmm. we are doing in other lights. We have identified a reservoir in the North Sea, which has never contained oil and gas, but which has the same properties as an oil and gas reservoir. So what characterizes an oil and gas reservoir and why that has been looked at as with interest also in order to store CO2 is that you have a cap rock on top of that reservoir, which is the reason why oil and gas has been kept in place in that reservoir for millions of years. Mm-hmm. Before being produced. So that means that you kind of have knowledge about the reservoir properties and can utilize that when storing oil and gas. But you can also identify similar type reservoirs which has never been used for oil and gas production as we have done. And the reservoir that we are developing in this first phase that that we are developing right now is 2,600 meters below the seabed. And it has not only one, but two seals. It's got a primary seal and a secondary seal. Mm-hmm. The well is penetrating through a number of geological formations until it reaches the storage reservoir, which is a sandstone reservoir, meaning that it's a very porous stone that will be able to absorb the CO2. Directly above this geological formation is a 75 meter thick layer of shale. And in many parts of the world, shale has been used on top of roofs of buildings, and that has been done for a reason, because it's completely tight; nothing penetrates through. So when it's raining, winter storms, whatever it is, you know, it will kind of keep the rest of the house or the structure dry, and that kind of illustrates the properties that this shale has. It's completely tight, and we're now talking about 75 meter thick layer of shale, so it's a very safe and solid seal directly over this reservoir. Mm-hmm. And then when you go a little bit further up, so to speak, in the structure, you will have a secondary seal, which is even thicker, and therefore, you know, this has been kind of studied. Data has been verified by the authorities, and the data has been made available also to anyone who wants access to them. So the reservoir data, the well data, everything we know about the reservoir is publicly available, and therefore independent specialists have also studied them and looked at this, and we use the opportunity to present these data whenever we can as well. Mm-hmm. And this is important because, you know, I can fully appreciate and understand that that this is being looked at with concern by people. You know, will it leak? Is it safe? How are we going to be sure that that this is going to be safely stored there for thousands of years, and that this whole thing is not a scam, so to speak. And therefore, you know, making these data available, having independent experts reviewing the data and following everything that we do has been an important principle.
Right. Yeah, I have also read, you know, that some have said that there are some danger, you know, with earthquakes and things like that. But I assume that you have studied all this, and so are these concerns unwarranted?
So in some parts of this area that we're talking about here, you have from time to time some micro seismicity in the geology in this area. If you talk to a specialist in this field, they would say that that's something that you will find everywhere. It's not all felt, but it's measured, and it can be monitored, and you will see a trend over time. So there has been a baseline around the microseismicity in this area done, and it's still being done and being developed, so that we kind of have a baseline before injection, start of injection, and therefore can compare and monitor over time how this is developing. So that's part of the monitoring program. Generally, I would say, you know, in this particular area where we're storing CO2, earthquake is not a big problem. Microseismicity, yes. Then whether this would be a problem or a challenge in other parts of the world, I cannot really say. I'm not a geologist either, so I shouldn't pretend to have all answers related to that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And what is the perception in Norway, in the Norwegian public, regarding these projects?
So public acceptance around what we're trying to achieve here in Norway is high. There hasn't been any major concerns. I think that has to do with the fact that there has been a lot of transparency around it, and it's been done since 1996. But also that I think this is being done far offshore. I think, you know, if it was done onshore, it would probably have been a very different thing. There has been a couple of attempts in other European countries in the past to develop storage capacity onshore. That has not been very successful. The public has been concerned, and therefore these projects and developments have been put away. But offshore, I think the concerns seem to be less. I think that we have a clear responsibility to share knowledge, experience, and data as we are doing, to make sure that people understand what we're doing and also understand what we're trying to achieve. The Norwegian public, as I said, has not expressed any significant concern when this project and the Longship, the Norwegian government's full-scale project, was launched. It also needed to be approved by the Norwegian Parliament then, and it was approved unanimously. So there was no concern at all among the political parties.
Mm-hmm. Now, so this is a very expensive project. I understand it might cost, you know, totally some $3 billion to finance all this. So are there products that can be made from carbon capture that can help finance the high costs? What about things like blue hydrogen to be used in hydrogen production? Is that a possibility?
But that's a slightly different thing altogether. Let me explain. So first of all, the total investment for Northern Lights are estimated at 14.2 billion Norwegian kroner for development and 10 years of operation. So that is in euros, that's about 1.4 billion euros. So, as I said, for development and 10 years of operation, and the state is covering part of that, and the remaining is being paid for by the owners. Then, obviously, capture is expensive as well. But what is going to pay for this climate change mitigation measure in the future is carbon pricing. Carbon taxation. In Europe, there is something called the ETS, which is a system where emitters need to pay for emissions, and or they need to buy ETS quotas, and so it's a trading scheme, and the price of the certificates right now, or allowances right now, are around 90 euros. I haven't checked the day, so I don't know exactly what it is today, but over the last month, it's been around 90 euros per ton. And that means that the cost of emitting CO2 is almost the same as the cost of investing in carbon capture and storage. Then if you ask me, it's quite simple. You know, get this going, invest in technology that can help mitigate climate change. And that's also what a lot of emitters across Europe are seeing today. And especially, you know, so the question they are probably asking themselves is, you know, how can I cut emissions so that I don't need to pay those 90 euros per ton? That could be through use of renewable energy in the cases where that is possible. It could be through other type of new technology that could make the production process more efficient, etc. And then for those emitters that do not have an alternative, the hard to abate sector, and then we're talking about cement waste incineration, as I mentioned, but also production of steel, for example, and certain other industries. Carbon capture and storage is what they're looking at. So that means that the technology and development of this technology is going to be paid for. So as a transport and storage operator, we will obviously charge a tariff for delivering these services, and that will be paid for by the emitter. Right now, for us, this is not a profitable business. We are hoping that it will be a profitable business in the future, but it will be far, far away from the margins that our owners have been used to in production of oil and gas. So it's a completely different ball game altogether. So it's not a very profitable business. It may become a little bit more profitable over time, but you know, we need to reduce cost. We need to be efficient in the way we operate, and we will see the ETS price or the CO2 taxation, going up. So a lot of things are happening at the same time.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us. It's been very enlightening to learn about all this. I've been speaking with Kim Bybrun, Communications and Government Relations Director for Northern Lights, who's working with Longship, project of the Norwegian government, regarding a full-scale carbon capture and storage project. So thank you so much, Kim, for joining us today and enlightening us about these very exciting projects.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks.